Good evening and welcome to Local Motion. This is Allie Lightfoot. Geologist Wayne Ranney recently spoke at the Sherboneau Theater in Ridgeway as part of the Sherb Talks lecture series. Ranney knows the Colorado Plateau like no other, with a career that started accidentally at the bottom of the Grand Canyon in the early 1970s. He has since scrambled his way across all the corners of the Colorado Plateau to a fresh geologic vantage of this remarkable region. Wayne sat down with KVNF's J.T. Thomas to talk about his rock work near and far. Here's that interview.
Ridgeway is a small place on the map with a very big view, and I love coming to this part of the world. There's so much geology. I got interested in geology back in the mid-1970s. Like a lot of people in that day and age, doing trips out west, and I became interested in national parks. And I ended up getting a volunteer job at the bottom of the Grand Canyon and did that for 3 years. And in those 3 years, I got all these rocks in my head. And that's why I became a geologist at Northern Arizona University. My specialty in geology is landscape development, how landscapes come to look the way they do, and educating people who are not geologists some of the magic and the wonderful things that can be known about geology, especially out here in the western United States.
So when you're down there in the bottom of the Grand Canyon in the early 1970s, did you overlap with Brad and Barbara Washburn at all while they were making some maps?
Yes, they were making those maps. I never got to meet them, but the guy who was the resource manager at Grand Canyon National Park in those days would oftentimes have them over at their house and talk about the things that he was doing with that, making that laser map for the Boston Museum.
I think he characterized it as a mountain that was upside down.
A lot of people have referred to it that way. When you go to the Grand Canyon, you do your hiking down first, and you go from higher elevation to lower elevation. So it's kind of like an inverted mountain, or an inverted piece of space anyway, but it's a beautiful space. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners had the opportunity to go to the Grand Canyon and probably love it as much as they love the Colorado Rockies or any other scene out here in western Colorado.
In the grand scale that is the Grand Canyon, is there any specific little detail that is in the news that turns you and gets you fascinated in the Grand Canyon?
Well, that would probably be the Colorado River. I don't know that I would call that a little muse, but the Colorado River has a wonderful history that is still not entirely known. And, of course, the Colorado River carved the Grand Canyon, and there would be no Grand Canyon without the river. So I would say that being on the river is a very special thing. It's a very magical thing. And hiking down to it is always a wonderful thing. And the river gives life to the Grand Canyon. When you look at it from the top, it looks like a painting. It looks like a postcard. It just kind of sits there. But the river really gives it some life. And anybody who's been down on the banks of the river really feels the power of the river and what it has done to carve that beautiful space there.
So when you started working down there, what was your first task there?
Well, I wasn't a geologist when I first went to the bottom of the canyon. I was a 21-year-old kid searching for something in life, and I stumbled into the Grand Canyon in a volunteer position. I wasn't even getting paid, and I got to live at a ranger station down at Phantom Ranch, a little small resort at the bottom of the canyon, and I would pick up trash, and I would check for camping permits, and I would patrol the trails and administer first aid. And in those days, rangers did everything. Rangers didn't just enforce the law or just interpret the landscape. They did a little bit of everything. So I met some wonderful people, and I remember one day a geology class from Northern Arizona University came through, and they were doing field work in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And I walked over to them, and I said, "What are you guys doing?" And they were putting pencil marks on a map, and they were mapping out rock formations. And I became intrigued by it because these rocks down there just have a way of getting in your face. It's kind of like looking at these snow-capped peaks here in Colorado. You have to notice them. So eventually I did that for 3 seasons, and then I went to Northern Arizona University and got a bachelor's and master's degree in geology. So I'm a child of the Grand Canyon in a way, geologically speaking.
Is there any one person that turned out to be a great mentor?
There was a couple of different mentors. I remember the first geology story I ever heard was from a resident and a geologist who now lives in Grand Junction, Peter Wynn. He was a boatman on the Colorado River, and he told me a geology story that I still remember and caused me to think through time. And that was the first time that I had an inkling that things were longer lived than human beings. There was also a curator of geology at the Museum of Northern Arizona, Bill Breed, and he kind of took me under his wing, and he had been to Antarctica and studied the Grand Canyon for decades, and I was just a young kid, and he was very interested in teaching me about geology. So there were a number of people that helped me along, and it's just incredible to think that now I'm in a place in my life where I'm in that role to some other younger person. But I guess that's the beauty of the circle of life.
So we went right down to the banks of the Colorado River starting this conversation. Let's zoom out of there and talk about the Colorado Plateau, which I think I use in my own parlance to tell people I live out on the Colorado Plateau. But if I had to define it, I don't know if I could be very accurate to explain the scope of that geology and the landforms that are in it. So could you give me a layman's definition of what the Colorado Plateau, where it is, how big it is, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I can do that, but let me just tell you that if the United States had developed the different states by measure of their geography rather than political lines, we would have 26 states. And some of those states would go by the name of the Appalachian Mountains, the Adirondack Plateau, the Great Plains, the Pacific Borderlands. The Colorado Plateau is one of these 26 geographic provinces. And it's bounded on the west by the Basin and Range Province, areas of western Utah and Nevada, and it's bounded on the east and the north by the Rocky Mountain Province. And the reason it's different is because it is an area of 130,000 square miles from the Uinta Mountains in Utah down to the Mogollon Rim near Sedona, Arizona. Just this fantastic place where the sedimentary rocks are colorful. They've been uplifted gently. They've been incised by large rivers. And all of this is set today in an arid environment. So if you take any one of those factors away, you won't have a Colorado Plateau. So it's very unique. I've been fortunate with my geology to go to 80 different countries looking for another Colorado Plateau. And as far as I can tell, there is not one. Patagonia comes close at the southern cone of South America, but it's not the Colorado Plateau. So it's a very unique landscape with an incredibly rich history that's recorded here, an ancient history that goes back far beyond humans.
So the way you described it, is that much of the same way that John Wesley Powell described it?
You know, it's interesting you should ask about him. I just finished a river trip in Cataract Canyon, and I reintroduced myself to some of his writings from Cataract Canyon. And the one thing that really comes through in his writings is how giddy he was about the geology. And a lot of people talk about the danger and the survival aspect of his river trip, but very few people read between the lines or maybe are not capable of seeing what he was really, really interested in being there. And one of the men on the trip, I think it was Howland, said the major would be very, very fine to go weeks with just eating beans and looking at rocks. I think he was captivated by this landscape, and it's amazing to think that through all that survival ordeal, he was still giddy about the rocks. That's the way I feel when I go down the river.
And that certainly inspired many generations since of river rats. We dwell down there, and I know a lot of friends that would be happy with a can of beans hanging out on the river and just doing that.
Absolutely.
To the bottom.
You know, another interesting thing is that the first people of European descent to ever see the Grand Canyon or the Colorado Plateau were members of the Coronado Expedition in the year 1540. And there were a number of other conquistador groups and miner groups and trappers. I have not been able to find any positive thing that was spoken about by any of those visitors. In fact, they talked negatively about the Grand Canyon. And yet in 1858, when the very first geologist saw the canyon, he sounded a siren call And every geologist that saw it during the 19th century went back again. They were the first ones to go back again. And I don't mean to say that you need to know the geology to really appreciate the Grand Canyon, but it certainly does help to understand this landscape if you know just a tiny bit about what has gone on here to create the landscape we see today.
So you've described a bit of the Republic of the Colorado Plateau. It incorporates a lot of different mountain ranges and a lot of different political boundaries. Just so that people who know where Arizona and Utah and Colorado and New Mexico meet, can you spell out a little bit more of where the Colorado Plateau lies and at what elevations and what else is in there?
Well, I was just charged by a publication for the Museum of Northern Arizona to define the Colorado Plateau, write an article about it. And there are some fuzzy areas to the boundary of the plateau, but if we start on the southern end in Arizona, the second most prominent landform in Arizona is called the Mogollon Rim. Most people would probably know that landform from if they've ever been to Sedona, Arizona. And if you go in a clockwise direction, you eventually come to an area just east of Las Vegas called the Grand Wash Cliffs. That's where the Colorado River spectacularly and abruptly leaves the Grand Canyon and the Colorado Plateau. And then you start to follow up through St. George, Utah, and Bryce Canyon National Park, and right along the edge of the Wasatch Mountains near Salt Lake City, and the boundary takes a turn over towards the Uinta Mountains in northeast Utah. This is one of those places where occasionally you'll see the boundary of the plateau drawn either south or north of the Uinta Mountains. I prefer to put it on the south side, but then it comes down into northwestern Colorado, the area around the White River. And right here in southwestern Colorado, there's another fuzzy boundary because of these San Juan volcanic rocks, these great eruptive materials that came out about 30 million years ago. And they were erupted out onto a plateau landscape and say sort of bury an ancient portion of the Colorado Plateau. So we oftentimes will draw a boundary outside of the San Juan Mountains such that Ridgeway, Telluride, and Durango sit right on the boundary with the Rocky Mountains and the Colorado Plateau. But if we go south from there, we typically follow the Rio Grande Rift and eventually through western New Mexico back to the Mogollon Rim in Arizona. And that's sort of outlined. If you think of all those places I just named, those are some very big all-star locations that people like to visit and like to go to. And so the boundary of the plateau is a very exciting place, although a lot of times I find myself kind of going towards the heart of it. Canyonlands, arches, cataract. The Grand Canyon's on the edge, but I find myself going there too.
As somebody, like I said earlier, who thinks of themselves living on the Colorado Plateau, my hackles almost went up with my sense of place, thinking, oh my gosh, am I not really on it?
Well, in my lecture, I'm going to show a number of these ancient paleogeographic maps that have the state and county lines superimposed on top of the ancient geography. And you'll be able to see Ouray County and La Plata County and Colorado and Utah. And when I always have a red dot located where I'm giving the lecture. So the red dot will be where Ridgeway, Colorado is located, right in the heart of Ouray County. And it's right on the boundary with the Colorado Plateau and the Rocky Mountains. So I'm not surprised at all that you don't know whether you're on the plateau or not, because there is these fuzzy areas that exist on the edge of the plateau in some areas.
With all the stuff you just described, is all of that in your book, Ancient Landscapes of the Colorado Plateau?
The book is, like a lot of geology books, is done chronologically. So we start out with the oldest landscapes, which in this part of the world go back 1,800 million years ago. That's the age of the rocks you see in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. Those rocks form the foundation or the basement of the Southwest. Then we describe sequentially through time all of the sedimentary layers that sit on top of that basement. My colleague, Dr. Ron Blakey, I was a student of his at Northern Arizona University. He's the one that developed these maps. And these maps are a really exciting way to access complex information in a digestible form. And I've had many people say to me that they never quite understood geology until they looked at this book. And I joke with people that I know that when they look at ancient landscapes of the Colorado Plateau, they're going there because of the maps. My role in the book was to write the text. And the text accompanies the maps and gives readers some verbal clues as to what the maps are representing. And I joke with people that it's a lot like a Playboy magazine in that people pick up the book and then they tell people, oh, I read the articles, not mentioning that they look at the pictures. Fortunately, I've had some good comments from people that they did enjoy the text and it was helpful for them to understand the text. And so that is described in this book, all of these ancient landscapes through time, from 1,800 million years ago right up to the end of the Ice Age 10,000 years ago. I should say a mere 10,000 years ago. Yeah, I mean, 10,000 years ago, there were already human beings on North America. There were probably people seeing the snouts of the glaciers coming down the Uncompahgre River, down the Animas River towards Durango. There were human beings that actually saw the huge ice sheet that used to sit on top of the San Juan Mountains. So they're our brothers, so to speak, those ancient people that used to be here.
I want to bring it to a more contemporary discussion here about something that you mentioned recently on your blog, and that was just a couple weeks ago we had this. For this area, it seems to me a rather spectacular slide that was up on the flanks of the Grand Mesa there. Can you tell me a little bit about that and why you're interested in that?
Landslides are being increasingly recognized as a real hazard to human population areas. There's a fantastic geologic record of ancient landslides, and you know the word ancient can either mean millions of years ago or it can mean 5,000 years ago, and geologists use it very loosely that way. But in this particular area on Grand Mesa, it was within a deposit known as the Green River Formation. This formation is where a lot of the tar shale and the tar sands are being targeted in the Colorado Plateau. These are freshwater lake deposits that are only about 40 or 50 million years old. They have a lot of mud in them. Because they're rather young, they're not well cemented. And when they get wet, they become mud, and mud likes to flow. And this was a particularly dangerous landslide because it was so fluidized, and it actually ran up and over a hill that it encountered as it came down from Sugarloaf Peak on the Grand Mesa. So on my blog, Earthly Musings, whenever there's landslides like this, I write about it, and I get some of my biggest hits from my landslide postings. Down in Arizona, we had a landslide that took out the road between Flagstaff and Page, Arizona, right near Lee's Ferry. And that highway is still closed 16 months later, and there's no chance that it's going to be open in the next 16 months. It's probably going to be closed for 3 years. And then we had the Oso landslide in Washington not too long ago, and then this big one in Colorado. The images of the slide from Grand Mesa were just astounding to see this half-mile-wide, four-mile-long piece of earth that let loose and destroyed everything in its past. And yet, when you look beneath the veneer of trees on the north slope of Grand Mesa, there are landslides everywhere within the Green River Formation, showing us that this is not unusual. It's catastrophic, but it's not unusual.
So in the continental United States, within months having a slide up in Oso and the one here, are there any correlations?
Well, these are vastly different deposits in vastly different parts of the world. One of the things that I've noticed geologically and with society is that the better that communications get, the more rapidly and more extensive things get reported. So in the pioneer days here in western Colorado, I don't know of any particular landslides, but if you think of the small population centers we had back in the 1880s or the 1890s, there could have been landslides and nobody really noticed it. So maybe it's just this background noise that people might start to think that we're having more events, but it might just be that there's better reporting and there's more people to get in the way. So I think these events are going to become larger and larger in our psyche because we have more and more people living in harm's way, so to speak. You know, the Earth is a living sphere. If for some reason all of the biosphere happened to be removed or destroyed, you could still call the Earth a living planet because it generates its own heat and it's geologically alive. Most people think of it as a living Earth because of the aspen trees and the animals that live on it, but it's alive geologically as well. And geologists are not dark people by and large, but you know, when a landslide happens, there's a little bit of excitement about that, especially if nobody is injured.
I asked a question about correlation, just because so much of today's conversation, of course, ended up being looked at in a big scale of stuff, climate change issues, people trying to make correlations with extreme weather events. All of a sudden, we have two very large landslides, so people are inclined, or at least reflexively, thinking that there might be some relationship to those extreme weather events. So it's good to hear, I know for myself, my own edification, that from a geologist's prism, you can look at it and say no, and there's a lot of indications that there's been a history of these kinds of slides in these respective deposits here on the Grand Mesa. And is that the case too up on in the Northwest in the Oso region? Is there a geologic record of slides akin to that one?
Yes, especially at the Oso region. I mean, that slide came down in an area that it had slides just in the last few decades, but also centuries ago. That those are very loose deposits that aren't well cemented. But your point is very well taken. I mean, if you look at things through time, you'll see that certain events might increase in their frequency as climate factors or tectonic factors start to play into them. So I don't mean to say that there is a background rate at which a landslide will occur. You might see clusters of landslides occurring for reasons such as climate change or changing rainfall patterns. I understand that at Grand Mesa there had been quite a bit of rain that had saturated the ground and possibly let loose on this. I also saw some chatter about fracking that was happening at the base of the slide, and that maybe that could have something to do with it. It's possible. I don't know if that's just chatter or what, but a geologist, by and large, would be a person who wouldn't get caught up in any non-scientific hype and would probably wait to reserve judgment until some data could be gathered. You know, if one of these were to let loose on another side of Grand Mesa, if you started to see a pattern, you might be able to say that maybe something has changed in the climate, in the tectonics, in the precipitation. Something has changed to maybe cause an increase in the rate. So, yes, certainly that is something that could be playing into it.
In a similar vein, I noticed you've also spent some time thinking and watching the fires that have been hitting Arizona this year. That's maybe on the veneer of this living earth that you're talking about. Can you tell me why a geologist who's so smitten with rocks in deep places like the Grand Canyon is so curious about watching what happens to the fire regime in the mountains and the canyons of Arizona?
Well, I think the rocks for me are just a proxy for change. I probably got interested in geology because I'm fascinated with change. I'm fascinated with things changing through time. So in many parts of the Mountain West, there's an increased fire danger because of the drought that's been going on for 12 or 13 years and the way that the forest have been mismanaged for 100 years. And there's an intersection going on here. At the same time that these long-term events have been going on, people have been moving into areas of the Mountain West, putting themselves in harm's way. And I think I'm just fascinated with the whole concept of change. You know, humans as a species have benefited from change. There's a South African anthropologist who said, "We are children of the Ice Age." And what he meant by that is if it weren't for the advance and retreat of glaciers in Northern Europe, we wouldn't have become the intelligent species that we did become because we could adapt to change. And yet most people I know are generally afraid of change on the short-term scale. They don't like things to change, and when things change, it kind of upsets their world. And I'm drawn to that philosophically. I'm drawn to that idea that we benefit and are harmed by change. And these fires are just a very small aspect of the natural world that I'm interested in.
Tell me what somebody learns in one of your classes. What's it like for them to look at the world at the beginning of the class and then at the end of the class?
Well, I think one of the benefits that they may not be aware of is that their view of the world expands. It expands, and they don't even know that it's expanding. But what typically happens with people who will listen to a lecture about geology is that they will come up to me and they will say, "I had no idea that all of those things happened here. no matter where it's at, if we're in Africa or Australia or Antarctica. And when they hear about them, they're interested in them. And they're surprised by that because they're normally not interested in those kinds of things. And so when science is delivered to them in a way that they can access it, where they can understand it and internalize it, it changes them. And I think they like that. I think they dislike the consumerism and the hype that is so prevalent on TV and on radio, not this station, of course, but other stations. I think people dislike that, and they're dissatisfied with it somehow on the inside. And when they touch the real world, there's something inside of them that tweaks a little bit, and they go, that's interesting. And geology is a great subject for that because most people don't know about geology. Most people don't know about geologic history. And yet there's a fantastic story out here everywhere we go.
I don't have all of my windows open right now. But speaking of being right here, we're looking out to the east, southeast. You see a bit of the Seminoles out there. And when you drive into this valley here in the Uncompahgre Valley, what catches your eye first?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, JT, because it's probably not what captures most people's eye. And I do like looking at the Cimarron Range. I do like looking back towards Ouray and seeing all of those mountains. But what catches my eye are these low, greenish, rounded hills that sit right on the outskirts of Ridgeway, deposits of the Manka Shale. And these record the very last time that the ocean was here in the Rocky Mountain region, about 80 to 90 million years ago. And I made it a point when I drove into Ridgeway this morning to take pictures of the Manka Shale. And of course, I did put the snow-capped peaks in the background because that's a hook that I can use to get people to say that's a pretty picture. But then I will draw their eye to these tiny hills of gray shale that represent the last time the ocean was here in Ridgeway, Colorado. That's what I see first. Thank you, JT. This has been great.
Wayne Ranney's most recent book, Ancient Landscapes of the Colorado Plateau, was a collaborative effort with his former university professor, the acclaimed cartographer, Dr. Ron Blakey. For more information about Wayne's work on the Colorado Plateau and the International Field Programs, visit wayneranney.com. That's WAYNERANNEY. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot. Stay tuned for As the Worm Turns, coming up next on KVNF.